This morning at 9:30 sharp, the gavel dropped and the questioning began. Supreme Court Justice nominee John Roberts went before the Senate Judiciary Committee for day two of his confirmation hearings. The senators wasted little time getting to some of the most controversial issues on the table, including abortion and presidential powers during wartime. We'll be providing daily updates on the hearings, and we'll take your calls and questions. What issues would you like to hear the committee address? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-TALK. And joining us now from the Senate Hart Office Building is David Savage, Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for joining us today, David.
Hi, Lynn.
And we should mention that the hearings have resumed from lunch break. We're going to go over what happened during the morning session, and we're going to begin with some tape. Here is Republican Senator Arlen Specter.
Judge Roberts, in your confirmation hearing for Circuit Court, your testimony read to this effect, and it's been widely quoted. Roe is the settled law of the land. Did you mean settled for you, settled only for your capacity as a circuit judge, or settled beyond that?
Well, beyond that, it's settled as a precedent of the court, entitled to respect under principles of stare decisis. And those principles, applied in the Casey case, explain when cases should be revisited and when they should not. And it is settled as a precedent of the court, yes.
You went on then to say, quote, it's a little more than settled. It was reaffirmed in the face of a challenge that it should be overruled in the Casey decision. So it has that added precedential value.
I think the initial question of a judge confronting an issue in this area, you don't go straight to the Roe decision. You begin with Casey, which modified the Roe framework and reaffirmed its central holding.
So, David Savage, we hear that the issue of abortion comes up almost immediately. And we hear the nominees say that Roe v. Wade is settled precedent. Maybe you can explain to us the significance of that exchange we just heard.
What I take from that, Lynn, is that he's telling the senators that he will not overturn Roe versus Wade lightly. And that's all I would take from it. He talked quite a bit about the importance of precedent, and he just described the various things the Supreme Court has said in the past as to how it views precedent. That is, it's not enough to just say the previous ruling is wrong. You've got to decide it's unworkable, that there's a great division on the court, that it has been eroded over time. People no longer believe its sort of central premises. He cited all those, and then he cited a series of cases where the Supreme Court has said things like that. And I was sort of paying attention to the cases because some of them are well-known, some are not, and about half of them were cases where the court had upheld a disputed precedent, and the other half were cases where they had overturned a disputed precedent. So I think Roberts was basically saying to them, precedent is important, but it doesn't carry the day all the time.
Yeah. Do you think that the answer that he gave, and I imagine he'll be asked about this again, will he not be? I mean, is that answer going to satisfy those who are really interested in the issue of Roe v. Wade?
I don't think it'll satisfy them in the sense that it'll reassure them that he really is going to stick by precedent. It's probably the best we're going to hear from him, though. He seemed to have this answer pretty well rehearsed in his mind. When I came back to it later, he said some of the same things. So I think he knows exactly what he wanted to say here, which is precedent is important. Usually we stick with precedent, but not always.
You expect him to be pressed on this more in the coming days?
Yes, sure. It seems to me that's the single, simple, most important question facing Roberts right now in these hearings. I think the public interest might be, are you going to vote to overturn Roe versus Wade? There's a lot of people who don't like Roe, and there's a lot of people who think it's an important precedent and should not be touched. It's a big division in the country. And if he stays on the court 30 years, he'll certainly have time to face it.
Yeah. Senator Specter also asked Judge Roberts about his views on privacy. How does that fit into this discussion?
Well, the Roe versus Wade case cited a right to privacy as the basis for it. So one of the minuets we've gone through in past confirmation hearings is the senators don't want to say, do you support Roe versus Wade? And so they say, do you support the right to privacy? And Roberts said very clearly he did think there was a right to personal privacy in the Liberty Clause of the 14th Amendment. And that, again, I think tells you something but not everything, because I believe Clarence Thomas said something like that as well. That is, he thinks there is a right to privacy, but then 8 or 9 months later, he turned around and voted to overturn Roe versus Wade.
If you'd like to join our discussion about the Senate hearings on the nominee for Chief Justice, the number is 1-800-989-8255. My guest is David Savage, Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times. We're going to take a call now from Nate in Concord, Michigan, or Concord, New Hampshire, I think it is. Hi, Nate.
That's correct.
Go ahead.
My question, I know that George Bush has stated several times that he wanted a strict constitutionalist judge. My question is, does that mean he wants a judge that's going to roll back everything since slavery and interpret the Constitution the way it was originally written?
What is meant by strict constitutionality, David Savage?
Well, it's a good question. I'm not sure George Bush would know the answer to that question. I assume when he uses the phrase strict constructionist, which is one of the phrases he's used, Richard Nixon used that, that means basically interpret the Constitution sort of close to its words. Don't be too expansive. Don't go off the deep end. But I don't think I don't think even people who use that phrase, to the extent that they think about it, really mean let's go back to 1789 or whatever and roll back everything. They mean sort of going forward. Interpret the Constitution strictly by its words. Don't go out, don't make up whole new principles and doctrines.
Okay, thanks for your call, Nate.
Thank you.
I want to move on to another part of today's questionings from Senator Patrick Leahy, the ranking member on the committee. He was the second member to ask questions, and we have some tape from his questioning. Let's roll that tape now.
Does Congress have the power to declare war?
Of course. The Constitution specifically gives that power to Congress.
Does Congress then have the power to stop a war?
Congress certainly has the power of the purse, and that's the way, as you noted earlier, that Congress has typically exercised.
But we know we did that in the Bolin Amendment and the Reagan administration, as we found out in the sorry chapter of Iran-Contra, went around that, violated the law, worked with Iran, sold arms illegally to Iran. I think that's one of our the axis of evil today. And to continue the war, the Contra war, in Central America. So the power of the purse, we've cut off money. The wars sometimes keep going. Do we have the power to terminate a war? We have the power to declare war. Do we have the power to terminate war?
Senator, that's a question that I don't think can be answered in the abstract. You need to know the particular circumstances and exactly what the facts are and what the legislation would be like. Because the argument on the other side, and as a judge, I would obviously be in a position of considering both arguments, the argument for the legislature and the argument for the executive.
David Savage, that was an interesting exchange. What was Senator Leahy getting at there, and what did he get from the candidate, from the nominee?
I thought it was an interesting exchange, too, Lennon. He didn't get much. He got less than I would have thought. I thought he asked a fairly simple question, which is if Congress has the power to declare war, which they do, the commander-in-chief then carries it out. If Congress says, as of September 1st, we want to end this war, doesn't that mean the war ends on September 1st? And Roberts said, no, I really can't answer that question. And there has been sort of a conservative doctrine that shows up in a number of places, including some of the memos written, the so-called torture memos, where lawyers have basically argued that the commander-in-chief, once a war begins, it's entirely in his prerogative and Congress can't interfere. And I would have thought Roberts would have said something like, yes, Senator, that's just obvious or just a truism, that if Congress can pass a law overriding the president's veto and say the war ends, then the war ends. But he said it's really sort of an open question and that he'd have to hear the arguments on the other side.
We are discussing the Supreme Court hearing on the nomination of John Roberts to the Supreme Court. If you'd like to join the conversation, or if you have any questions for our guest, give us a call at 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And let's take a call now from Karen, and she's in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Quick question. I hope it's not too elementary. Why would John Roberts be considered for the Chief Justice instead of just a Supreme Court judge? Why wouldn't they hire or promote within the justices to take that Chief Justice position?
Well, Karen, it's a presidential appointment. The Chief Justice is a separate slot. The president gets to appoint that person. It's not a vote taken by the justices. It's not a matter of seniority. As you probably recall, in mid-July, Roberts was originally nominated by President Bush to take Sandra O'Connor's seat when Chief Justice Rehnquist died on September 2nd, I believe it was. Just 2 days later, President Bush decided to sort of change course and nominate John Roberts to be Chief Justice and fill the Rehnquist slot. So it's entirely the president's prerogative.
I see. All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks for your call, Karen. I think a lot of people have asked questions about that, but it's a fairly common. It's actually more the tradition to nominate the Chief Justice from outside the court, is it not?
Yes, that's right. There have been several from inside the court, but I think it's like 2-1 the other way. Most of them have come as new appointees come from outside the court.
David Savage is a Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. If you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call, the number 1-800-989-8255. David, something interesting that we've been hearing over these 2 days that I find interesting and I'd like you to talk about a little bit. Judge Roberts talks a lot about judicial modesty, judicial humility. He compared the role of a judge to an umpire. What does that tell us about his judicial philosophy?
Well, I agree again, Lynn. It's really interesting themes. It is something that echoes what Republican senators said yesterday and a lot of conservatives have said for a long time. I suspect a lot of ordinary Americans think it's an appealing thought, which is judges shouldn't be making the law. Roberts today said something like, you can't imagine the framers getting together in whatever, 1787, and saying, why don't we let all the hard questions be decided by unelected judges? That's not the way a democracy should work. And he wants to continue to say, I view judging as a very limited role of applying the law, not making the law. And I want to bring, you know, modesty and humility to the job. And I think a lot of people around the country would instinctively think that sounds pretty good. We don't want the Supreme Court deciding all the big questions of the day because they are fundamentally unelected people and they don't represent the views. And if you get a decision you really disagree with, there's nothing you can do about it. And so I think it's something that he feels strongly about. He says it over and over again. And it's certainly something that the Republican senators echo over and over again.
Now, the judge is, Judge Roberts is, he's a very measured man, I think, in the way he's responding, which, of course, yesterday Republican senators were urging him to be measured in his responses, which may be causing a little bit of frustration on the part of Democrats. There was a kind of heated exchange between Democratic Senator Joe Biden and the nominee. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you're right. Roberts is saying the least possible on some controversial matters, basically saying he can't state an opinion because some of these issues will come back before the court. I'm not sure exactly what Biden questioned him for about a half hour and got increasingly irritated at Roberts and one time called his answers misleading. They were really debating a series of civil rights issues early in the Reagan administration. There was, you know, one of the ones was this Grove City case, and it, as I say, it goes back to the early 80s. But here's the basic issue. Title IX said something like, any institution or program receiving federal financial funds may not discriminate based on sex. So what about a private college that doesn't get federal funds, but some of its students get federal aid? That was the issue. The liberal view was those colleges, even those private colleges, should be covered entirely. The Reagan administration took the view, and the Supreme Court agreed, that the college is covered only to the extent that of its admissions office. Well, that really limited Title IX in private colleges because, say, for example, the sports program wouldn't be covered. So Congress went back and changed the law, the so-called Civil Rights Restoration Act, and said if you get any money, the entire college is covered. And I think some Senator Biden and to some degree Senator Kennedy wanted John Roberts to say something like, well, I think I really regret some of those views. I said, you know, wrote about 25 years ago, and I've sort of changed my mind. But Robert stuck to his opinion. He gave a very legal argument. He didn't budge and didn't move at all, and basically said, I was arguing the position the administration took, and that was their position, and it wasn't mine.
Well, clearly the Democrats want to be tough with the nominee. On the other hand, do they run some risk of looking too partisan or of badgering this person who seems to be a very reasonable person? I mean, how effective are they being with this tough questioning?
That one's a hard one for me to answer because it, to some degree, depends on in the eye of the beholder. But I think you're correct to say that they do look like they can be badgering him and not very effectively. That's one. Most of the senators are better at talking than they are at answering questions.
Or asking questions.
Pardon me?
Asking questions?
Yes. They talk a lot. You know, they've got 30 minutes to ask questions, and they spend 10 or 15 minutes doing a lead-in to their first question and then say, Judge, could you comment on that? It's more effective if you ask sort of a pointed question, listen to the answer, and then follow up. And so a lot of the Democrats have been sort of frustrated. They've been giving speeches, and they haven't been able to pin down Roberts and get clear answers. And it's just unfortunate that some of these, the older senators have been in the Senate a long time and doing a lot of talking, and that they don't have that prosecutor skill of sort of asking tight, crisp questions that demand an answer.
Prosecutors or journalists will have to give them some lessons, huh? Thanks so much for being with us today, David.
Thank you, Lynn.
David Savage is the Supreme Court reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and he'll be with us again tomorrow. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington.